We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
Back to 1 Corinthians. We were looking at 1 Corinthians earlier this year, and we've had a break from it and now returned, and we're looking at the next four or five chapters. 1 Corinthians is a book which changes, it seems, topics a lot and yet deals with similar issues and similar arguments. The topic we're going to look at over the next 3 weeks seems a strange one when you first hear it. Food offered to idols is not particularly every person's concern in our society or every Christian's concern in our society. Most of us have never seen an idol temple, let alone been offered food that's been offered to idols. Although if you're offered the Hare Krishna food, that's been offered to idols. That's part of it. There is a little bit, and down Kensington, one of the Chinese shops I eat my evening meals from time to time, I notice that there's a corner in the corner, a little some little form of idolatry and food that is left to the ancestors that are tucked away there in the corner. So it's a growing factor of our life in the future as our society becomes more varied, more multicultural, or whatever it may be. That is, coming from a Christianized society, as we do, idol temples aren't around. But those of us who come from a non-Christianized society, well, there were idol temples where we grew up, and we saw all forms of, all kinds and manners of idolatry, and food, eating, has a lot to do with much of idolatry. Corinth was a much more varied community than Sydney. It was a great crossroads of the sea world, great port city, a fairly King's Cross-ish kind of area, with many of the sailors of the world gathered into this one town, a fairly new and very prosperous city. All kinds of religious practices were there. The Jews were there, as well as the very much larger community of the pagans, of course, who indeed worshipped all kinds of different gods, many gods. There was no sense in which you had to be loyal to any one in particular. Corinth was a city that was full of idolatry. After the apostle had preached the gospel there and a church had been founded, you have some Christians who were Jewish and therefore had particular problems about food and what you do with food and how it's killed, and have particular problems with idolatry because Judaism had always taken such a strong stance against idolatry. And then you had some God-fearers, some pagans, who had seen the stupidity of idolatry and had joined themselves up with the Jewish community and had rejected that style of life. And there were some out-and-out pagans who had been converted straight out of the idol temple, so to speak, and they were now sitting in church together. Now, they had very different cultures, and they had very different religious cultures, and they had very different experiences of idolatry. And it was not as if it was something that you could just kind of get away from. It'd be very hard to go down to the local butcher shop and buy some meat that hadn't been offered to some idol somewhere, sometime. And indeed, when you went out to eat, you didn't go to a restaurant, you went to an idol temple. And there in the temple, you would feast together on the food. It was all part of the place where you went for the party, when someone was born, when there was a marriage, even when there was a funeral. Idolatry would be caught up in it because you would go to the temple and there you would have a great barbecue. The food that was offered to the idols was not kind of left for the idols to eat. The food that was offered to the idols was then shared with all the participants. And caught up with idolatry was always nearly sexual immorality. In fact, nearly every time you find it referred to in the Bible, you find it referred to in the context of sexual immorality as well, because the whole activity was basically having the local orgy. That was the character of it. We tend to have a very Christianized view of religion, where we think religion has always got to do with a holiness of morality, but many of the religions of the ancient world, many of the religions of idolatry, are actually caught up with the occult and caught up with immorality as part of their pattern. But yet when you read 1 Corinthians 8 first up and the food offered to idols, you think, well, this is a part of the Bible that really has got very little to do with me. But friends, think again. Not only will there be the times in which our society will have more idolatry, not only will be the times when you will travel and therefore be caught up in it, but the principles that Paul uses to discuss this issue, the principles have wide application well and truly beyond the subject of idolatry. The principles have application to our knowledge, to our consciences, to the way in which we relate to each other, to the liberty and freedom we have in different issues. You see, Christians from our different backgrounds have varying attitudes to a whole range of issues. How do Christians live with each other when we disagree about right and wrong? We disagree about important issues. When I was in England, I was talking to a group, a family group of house, it was a house party for families, and I was speaking to the parents, really, on the whole subject of love, sex and marriage, and did it from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and I was speaking about the importance of sex within marriage, and at question time at the end of one of the sessions, it was very interesting to see the divisions within the community of parents of that particular church. One of the fathers was deeply offended by what I had said and thought that it was inappropriate that Christians should speak so openly and candidly on the subject of sexuality. Even within the context of a group of Christian families, he thought that there are things that are better never said. I think in part that why I was invited to go and preach in England was because there are many things that Englishmen think are better not said and that other Englishmen think would be much better to be said but don't know how to, and so they import an Australian. I think it has to do with that, really, and so I said them, and sure enough, there was the reaction that it shouldn't have been said because you don't talk about that kind of subject. And he had a very interesting point to bring forward when the discussion pursued further. He said, if you know what is right and true, you do not need to know what is wrong. That point came up because one of the other fathers took issue with him and said, no, these things have to be talked about, and they have to be talked about with our kids. No longer do we live in an age where you grow up in naivety, protected by social structures. We now live in an age in which there are no social structures that will protect anybody, and therefore we have to raise our children with knowledge. We have to teach them what the world is like so that they'll be protected by their own consciences saying that is right and that is wrong and I will do what is right and I won't do what is wrong. And so he said, if my children said to me they were to go along to an X-rated movie, I'd take them. Don't know what the kids think about that, but that was the father's attitude. Well, the man who thought that I shouldn't even be speaking on the subject was not enamoured with the idea that a Christian would be taking his children along to X-rated movies. And so a, for Englishmen, very warm conversation ensued as to how far do we go in educating our children, in exposing our children to the moral contamination of the world. And the one man says, you teach that which is right, that which is pure, that which is holy, that which is decent, that which is godly. You just teach the truth. And that is all that you need to know in order to live. It does not help you to hear of the error. Whereas the other man is saying, well, of course, you must expose them to the errors that they're going to be faced and discuss those and point out what is wrong. The two really moved into, not antagonism, but into difficulty in relationship with each other. For both had strong moral principles that ran in complete contradiction to each other. How could they actually allow their children to play cricket with each other? How could they continue in fellowship in congregational life together? 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10 is about those kinds of issues. Not just food offered to idols. Food offered to idols was the symptom of the problem in Paul's day, but Paul handles the symptom by looking at the disease, at knowledge and conscience and freedom of conscience and relationships with each other. He looks at the disease on this particular issue. If food offered to idols is your particular symptom and problem at the moment, well, these passages certainly relate to it, but it relates to a whole thing. See, there's a series of books that are out now attacking rock music from a Christian perspective, seeing it as something that is demonic, something that Christians cannot be involved in. You see, some Christians are all for rock music. Rock, and just as general term, particular type, but just that kind of music. There are some Christians all for, because they say that is the music of our age and our generation. your age, your generation if you prefer. That is the music of our age and our generation. If we're going to communicate with the people of our society, then we must communicate in their language, and that is their language, in their emotions, and that is their emotions. But this must be able to be expressed. After all, music is just noise. It's just a series of noises put into certain patterns and formats, and there's nothing evil in noises themselves. But then there are other people who will say, no, it's not quite like that. Within our cultural context, the music has a philosophy. It has an attitude towards establishment, towards authority. It has an attitude towards love and hate and hostility. Not just the words, but the very musical mood and methodology itself has an attitude of manipulation of an audience, which is unacceptable as a form of expressing the gospel, because it is preaching the exact reverse of what the gospel is trying to say. And yet others say, no, it's all caught up really with the occult. It really is caught up with the demonic use of noise and patterns, and apart from whether there's messages from the devil going on the tape recorder going backwards or the records going backwards and all that. I don't know why people pay records backwards to find out what the messages are, but there are caught up in it demonic aspects, so that people who get involved in a particular rock culture, it's not just that they move into a mindset that is in opposition to the gospel, but they come under the power and influences of evil. And some of the people who are most heavily into the rock scene are the ones who, having been converted out of it, are most antagonistic towards it and perceive in it an evil which those of us who actually move down to 2CH whenever we hear it don't even understand, and therefore don't understand the argument. There are books on the subject that Christians have written saying that rock music is demonic. Well, apart from the question of whether it is or it isn't, how do Christians hold together when you've got one group who want to be using it for evangelism and think it's fundamental to our outreach to the world today, and you've got another group who's saying it's actually of the devil? How can we continue in fellowship in this area? Who is to give to whom what rights of freedom within fellowship to? Paul starts off his argument really about the subject of God. Do the other gods exist? That's where he starts. Do the other gods exist? And the answer is no and yes. The Old Testament has taught clearly that there is no God but one, and that God is Yahweh. Every Jewish child was raised with a great statement that comes out of Deuteronomy 6, which says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength." The God is one. He is unique. And not just that he is one, unique, but in all the world he is one. So the Isaiah 45 passage that was read for us, "I am God and there is no other. There is no other God but me," says the Yahweh. In Zechariah 14:9, it is look forward to a time when all the nations will acknowledge that the Lord is one. He is the king over the whole world. And his kingdom will be seen in his uniqueness, that he is acknowledged as the one. Zechariah 14:9, "The Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day there will be one Lord, and his name, the only name. There is no other God but one." It's not just that there is one God for Israel and another God for the Moabites and another God for the Girgashites. There's one God in all the world. It's not two gods, the good God and the bad God, at war with each other. There is one God who rules over everything. And so Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians 8, verse 4, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. People build statues to a Baal, they build a statue of Dagon, but there is no Baal. There is no Dagon, except in the fertility of their own imaginations. Those things don't actually exist. The statue exists, but the God that the statue is supposed to represent does not exist. He has no existence at all. For us Christians, we acknowledge that there is only one God. Not to say that for other people there's other gods and those other gods exist. He's saying they don't exist. He's saying what we are professing is one God in all the world. The Father of all, verse 6. The Father who has created all things and for whom we live. And the Son, Jesus, who is the Lord, the one Lord that Zechariah was looking forward to, the Master, who is the agent of all creation and the agent of our new life, the one through whom all things came into being and through whom we live. This one God is the only God, and there is no other. But on the other hand, yes, of course, there's many gods. Idols abounded in the ancient world as well as the modern. There were meats offered to this and that god, and all over the place you could have temples for this god and such. And indeed today people worship all kinds of things. Materialism most commonly in our society, but the religious bric-a-brac industry is massive in our society. The astrology columns occur in every page, don't they? That people believe in the powers of the planets and their movements, etc. It's all just part of the world we live in. That you can go and read your Shirley MacLaine books and discover new things every day as she believes in more and more of the other world. I did enjoy that question that somebody asked her publicly about whether there was anything in the world she didn't believe in. Yes, there are many, many gods. There are many things that people will worship as God. We in modern English have an advantage over the ancient Greek in that we've got upper class and lower case letters, so that there's capital G God and there's lots of little g gods. There's lots of gods in the world that people will worship as gods. But they have no existence, you say, in terms of a spiritual force. That's right. And so you may be tempted to say, okay, well then there are no spiritual forces other than God. And then you'd be wrong. Because there are other spiritual forces than God. The others are not God, but they are there. And the others that are there use idolatry to bring about their purposes. This is not discussed yet in chapter 8, but I'll just do a preview for you. If you come across to chapter 10, verse 18, 19, do I mean then that a sacrifice offered to an idol, 10, 19, is anything? Or that the idol is anything? No, you see, the idol's nothing. The sacrifice offered to the idol's nothing, no. But the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God. And I want you not to participate with demons. There are supernatural forces at work. Not God, not even gods, but those who are in opposition to God, and they utilize false worship. The effect, friends, of course, is that false worship works. Here's what balks so many people who play with the occult, who play with astrology, who play with the seances and the Ouija boards and all the rest of it. The trouble is the things work. And it really balks people. Those of us who have grown up and been born as sceptical as I have, and those of us who have been converted as early as I was, and have therefore not really been involved in those things, we sit back and think, well, it's all just stupid. It's just crass superstition. But those of us who have engaged in the occult, in any and many of its many varied forms, very often can tell us that there was a power there that quite surprised them, that quite astonished them, that really amazed them. Over and over again, you'll meet up with the girls who in the high school days started playing with Ouija boards. It was all very fun, but then suddenly things started to happen and they got scared and so they stopped doing it. Doesn't make sense to me. I think it's just stupid. But the Bible does talk about the demons. It does talk about powers and principalities of evil that are alive and work in this world. And if people put themselves in touch with those things, then they can find powers. That is, those people who have been caught up in idolatry in the past very often speak of the power of the idols and are convinced of the power of the idols, so that although they've left idolatry to worship the true and living God, yet they know the idols had power. They assume that means the idols actually did represent the God, rather than thinking it out clearly that actually the demons were using the idolatry to bring about their work. A man used to come visiting my home very regularly and always was asking me difficult Shirley MacLaine kinds of questions. He always was reading new books, the latest wonder books of wonderment and crass superstition, as far as I was concerned, and treating me as an unbeliever because I didn't believe in American destroyers that disappeared and reappeared 3 days later with their whole crew mad. I didn't believe in little black boxes that Russians had developed which could capture people's auras. I didn't believe in blood samples being sent across to the other side of the world to be analysed by astrological symbolism so as to be able to tell people of the diseases they have and the cures they could get. I didn't believe, I tell you, I've heard them all. Well, I thought I'd heard them all, but every time he comes, he's got a new one. And each time it was, why don't you disprove this to me? Because I believe this, I believe this, I believe this. I mentioned Jesus rose from the dead. That's a nothing, I tell you. Compared to what he knew, everything was important, and he wouldn't investigate anything that I... It was my dear wife who put him right, as she is much cleverer than I. For once she went to the door instead of me. I was hiding. And instead of trying to disagree with him like the materialistic skeptic that I am, she did the right thing. She accepted his view of the supernatural and asked him one question, which really has silenced him now. I'm relieved. She said, how do you know that all these things are for good and not for evil? Now, that thought had never crossed his mind. He always assumed that if you were in touch with the supernatural, that it would be good, that it would be helpful, that it would enhance your life, that you would find out truth, that you would be able to be integrated and in touch with the universe, that you would really have power. He wanted power in his life. Never crossed his mind that when he got in touch with the other side, he might actually be in touch with evil. That hadn't crossed his mind till my dear wife helped him out. Here is the problem, you see. People are in touch with these gods as they think of them. Well, we know there are no other gods. But it doesn't mean they're not in touch with the evil and the evil one who uses these gods. It's the same with many of these kinds of areas of life, isn't it? But people who have been converted from them, people who are caught up in them, genuinely believe that there is some power at work there. And I'm sure there are people here who believe it themselves, who can talk about experiences they've had or their family have had which are beyond their understanding, which don't fit into the normal category of materialistic thought, who they've got no explanation from, something that happened. I would think most of us have got that in our experience in life. Certainly the surveys have demonstrated that most Westerners have them. It's just something that's taboo as a subject. You're not allowed to mention it because people will think you're nuts. And if you've come from an active participation in it, well, it's very easy to see now that I've become a Christian, I don't want to have anything to do with it, and no one else should have anything to do with it. But then there are other people who say, well, there's nothing in it, really. I mean, I know God is God, and therefore I'm not afraid of things that go bump in the nut. I don't think there are those supernatural things. I don't think... Do other gods exist? No. And yes. And the key to it is what your knowledge is about. Christianity is about knowledge, you see. Christians are people who are in the know. We all possess knowledge, as he said in verse 1. We possess knowledge of God. That is what we all possess. In turning from the idols to the true and living God, we have come to know him. As it says in 1 Corinthians 2:16, we have the mind of Christ. Knowledge lies at the heart of Christianity. More important than what we know, though, of course, is being known by God, verse 3. The man who loves God is known by God. I'm walking down Oxford Street. And there, lie, lay me down, it's not Bob Hawke right in front of me. And I say, hello, Bob. What is impressive is, when I was walking down Oxford Street, and lay me, there's Bob Hawke in front of me. And he says, hello, Philip. Now, that's much more impressive, isn't it? Any one of us can say hello, Bob, but which one is Bob going to say hello to in the first name here? That's much more impressive. That you know God is one thing. That God knows you is much more impressive. Whom does God know? It's the one who loves God, who is known by God, who is really on the in. That is, knowledge is something that all Christians have of God, but it's something that's got some difficulty about it. At the end of verse 1, it puffs up. That the man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know. Not all Christians even have this knowledge. Well, not total knowledge, shall we say. That is, all Christians are people on the know in God. They know God and are known by God. But that doesn't mean they know everything. In fact, imagining that they know something, they often are more foolish than they ever imagined. Because knowledge has a tendency to puff you up in arrogance. It's a great danger of knowledge. A little knowledge, very dangerous for people. Remember old Socrates, you see, he was wiser than everybody else in the world because he knew one thing and only one thing. That is, he knew nothing. The difference between him and everybody else is they thought they knew something. Whereas he knew nothing. Putting one up on everybody else, you see. We tend to think we know something because we know God. We tend to think we know everything because we know God. Here are some Christians who don't know everything. You see them mentioned there in verse 7? Not everyone knows this. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that they, when they eat such food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to their idols. That is, some of us know that there is only one God and no God else in the rest of the world. And therefore we know that food that is offered to the other gods is just food. It hasn't been contaminated by the other gods at all. It's just exactly the same as before it was. And if it was good quality rump steak beforehand, it's good quality rump steak after it. If it's lousy rump steak before, it's lousy afterwards. It's exactly the same. It hasn't altered. Because the gods don't exist. But some people, especially those who have been caught up in idolatry for a long, long time, you see, they may have come out of it, but they know the power of the idolatry. And they still think that somehow the idols will be able to get at them through the food. That somehow they'll come under the power of the idols. I know that music is just noise. Just organised in certain patterns. That's all it is. Got nothing more to it than that. But you see, I've never come under the power of evil. It has not been part of my occult background because, thanks to the mercy of God, I've never been caught up in that. And so it seems weird to me that some people think that there's something evil about rock music. I just think that's peculiar because I know better than them. And you see how easy it would be knowing better than them to be puffed up in my knowledge and think they're very inferior people, really. They haven't understood the thing properly yet. They're still caught up, but they know what they know. They know how they used to live. They know how they used to use that music. They know how they got caught up in that whole scene. They know what effect it has upon them and how it reminds them of all patterns of evil that they were caught up in. They know the power that was involved, and they can't understand why I can't see it as a problem. They think there's something defective about me. Not all have the knowledge of God properly. And the knowledge we have has a tendency to puff us up. That's very important, isn't it? Because so often we think that people have grown in maturity because they've grown in knowledge. And that is not the case at all. You can grow in knowledge and still be immature in godliness. Because your knowledge can all be used by you to puff you up. It is love that builds up. Knowledge puffs up. Makes you a windbag. You see it in prayer and Bible groups. I hope you're all in prayer and Bible. See, if you're not in prayer and Bible groups, do come and check with us. Check with someone at the door. Come and see me if you can't find someone else about it. It's very important to be in a group of people who are studying the Bible and praying with each other and encouraging each other and building each other up. But sometimes when you get in little Bible study discussions, have you noticed how what we really are doing is so caught up in the intellectual discussion that we start just scoring points off each other? Who can look up the verse quicker? Who's got the latest number of verses to rattle out? Who has memorized the number of verses? Who can open up to Malachi in one hit and get it? Jeremiah. Never mind, next time. And I am mature because I am cluttered up in my mind with lots of knowledge, and that's not maturity. That's arrogance. That may be more of an indication of your intelligence or your education or of your just memory. It may be no indication of your obedience to God. The mature person is one who loves God and is known by God and is built up. And if you are like God, then your concern will be for other people. Your concern won't be for yourself and for scoring points off them, but for building them up. If you are building yourself up in godliness, then you'll be concerned to build other people up in godliness. And so the way in which you speak will reflect it. Listen to Ephesians 4:29. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. Those of us who are great talkers and those of us who have grown in knowledge, we need Ephesians 4:29 memorised. That's the good verse to memorise. You won't win many arguments with it, but if you took it as a motto of life, you may do a great work of godliness, mightn't you? To make sure that when you speak for the benefit of the other person, to build them up. Your concern won't be for yourself and for scoring points off them, but for building them up. If you are building yourself up in godliness, then you'll be concerned to build other people up in godliness. And so the way in which you speak will reflect it. Listen to Ephesians 4:29. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. Those of us who are great talkers and those of us who have grown in knowledge, we need Ephesians 4:29 memorised. That's the good verse to memorise. You won't win many arguments with it, but if you took it as a motto of life, you may do a great work of godliness, mightn't you? To make sure that when you speak for the benefit of the other person, to build them up, to help them in their needs. Love builds up. Knowledge puffs up. And so there are these two people contrasted in the passage, the weak and the knowledgeable. The weak are those who lack knowledge. Let me say it again. Note takers, take it down. The weak are those who lack knowledge. I emphasise it because we usually think of the weak as those who give in to temptation. That's not what Paul is speaking about in this passage. Because the weak are weak before they fall into temptation in this passage. In fact, they fall into temptation because they are weak. They're not weak because they fall into temptation. In a parallel passage in Romans chapter 14, the abstainers from food offered to idols, the abstainers from meats and from wines, the people who have high, strong principles, who will not eat any contaminated, defiled food, they are the weak. We tend to think they're the strong. They're the people with, we call it, strong principles. Paul says they're the ones with weak principles. Anybody can be a vegetarian. That's neither here nor there. You've got to have real strength to go beyond vegetarianism. To refuse to drink alcohol. Well, anybody can refuse to drink alcohol. That's a weakness. To be able to drink alcohol, that requires strength. Now, that's not the way we normally talk, is it? It's not the way we think. Check out Romans 14. The weak here are not those who give in to temptation. The weak here are those whose knowledge is lacking. They're still Christians, you'll see, in verses 10, 11, 11, 12, 13, because they're called brother. So this weak brother for whom Christ died, verse 11, verse 12, when you sin against your brothers in this way, verse 13, therefore if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, they're Christians. That is, they know something of God. They, in fact, are known by God because they may well love God, but they are weak Christians. Because they lack knowledge. They do not know that the idols are nothing. They do not know that what you eat brings you no closer to God or takes you no further away from God. But what you eat is what you eat. But the food is of no consequence to godliness. They do not know rightly. And because they do not know, they are easily led astray. Because their knowledge is lacking, because they're ill-informed, their conscience is weak, and they are easily led astray. See, that's why we work hard week after week here teaching the Bible and encouraging you in prayer and Bible groups and encouraging you week by week here to study the Bible. Because as you grow in knowledge, so you are able to stand in firmness. But when you are ignorant as a Christian, it's very hard to know which way you should go on any particular issue. Because you don't know what's right, you don't know what's wrong. You continue to flounder around from one opinion to another opinion. The latest book you've just read or the latest Christian you've just met, you just do what they do or say what they say, but you do not know what is right because you haven't read the scriptures for yourself and studied them to try and understand what they're saying. And because you do not know what is right, you are easily led astray. They're ill-informed about idols. They're ill-informed about meat offered to idols, food offered to idols, and so their conscience is weak. And being weak, it is easy to be destroyed. Verse 7 talks about it being defiled. Verse 11 talks about it being destroyed. Verse 12 talks about it being wounded. Verse 13 talks about people falling. Each of them over food offered to idols. Now here's the subtle point. Grasp hold of it. There's a very subtle point, very important, that most people miss. If I stick my teeth into this rump steak, I am sticking my teeth into a piece of rump steak. Will this affect me spiritually? No, I'm just sticking my teeth into a piece of rump steak. Might affect my teeth, might affect my stomach, might affect all, it won't affect me spiritually. I'm no closer to God because I've eaten it. I'm no further away from God because I've refused to eat it. It's an irrelevance. I'm just eating rump steak. But if I believe that it is evil to eat rump steak, if I believe God does not want me to eat this piece of rump steak because it's been offered to Dagon or Baal or Zeus or whoever, if I think that God wants me not to eat it and I stick my teeth into it, then it is sin to eat it. Two people eating the same piece of steak. For one, it's sin. For the other, it's irrelevant. Where's the difference between them? It's not in the steak. It's not in the teeth. It's in the attitude towards God. For one is saying, it is perfectly all right for me to eat this, and so they're eating it. The other is saying, it is wrong for me to eat this, and they're eating it. They are doing what they think is wrong. They are defiling their consciences. They are going against their consciences. They're saying, God does not want me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. They are rejecting God. So for them, it is indeed sin. Not because of the idol, nor indeed because of the steak, but because their conscience has been ill-informed. Come back and see the point I'm making in verse 7. Not everyone knows this about gods and food. Not everyone knows this. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to an idol. And since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. Pick up again verse 10. For if anyone with a weak conscience sees you who have this knowledge eating in an idol's temple, won't he be emboldened to eat what has been sacrificed to idols? And so this weak brother for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. It's because his conscience is weak that the activity destroys him. So you say, what's the alternative to being weak? And you would want to say, well, to be knowledgeable. And I want to go for knowledgeable, but it's not really to be knowledgeable because there are knowledgeable people here, but their knowledge is such that puffs them up. So that they say, well, I know that there's nothing in it. I can eat the food anyway. And they do not concern themselves with the good of their brother. They are so full of their knowledge that they do not love God and his people. Their arrogance has taken hold of their behaviour, because there is a knowledge which destroys, a knowledge which destroys other people. Here's the problem. For many of us are caught up in the knowledge industry. Many of us are well educated in this community of Australia. Many of us are well educated in this community of this congregation. And we believe in education, and more fool us for believing in it. We believe that knowledge is power, and more fool us for believing in it. We believe it's good to be knowledgeable, to grow in knowledge and understanding, and more fool us, because there's a whole range of knowledge that many of us wish we never had. Coming into our harbour this day has been navies from around the world. Going out into our harbour today was people who were saying, we wish we didn't have the atomic knowledge that you've got. It would be better never to have discovered this. And now we have discovered, we wish you'd put it away and not use it. There's lots of knowledge like that, isn't it? Genetic engineering. It could be used for such good, couldn't it? But oh boy, it could be used for such disaster, couldn't it? Knowledge can destroy as much as help. And the key is not having knowledge, the key is using it properly. And how do you use it properly? In love. That's how you use it properly. And these people are not using it in love. They're not seeking to build up, they're just seeking to be arrogant in their own knowledge. Indeed, the suggestion is that they're really using it to put down. You're still worried about food offered to idols. You're clearly not a very mature Christian, are you? You haven't grasped hold of the truth yet, have you? You don't know about idols properly yet. Look, I know these things. I can eat the food. It doesn't contaminate me at all. There's a marvellous opportunity for the young Christian, especially, who is struggling with his past and all the powers and principalities he used to live under and of which he is still scared, to be put down by the knowledgeable Christian, isn't he? For the Christian who can say, well, it's all right for me. I can eat this stuff. Doesn't affect me. I've been eating food offered to idols for 10 years now, and my Christian life couldn't be stronger. By your actions, you can be emboldening, you can be encouraging somebody whose conscience is weak to go against his conscience. And as you encourage him to go against his conscience, he is being destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. You are sinning against your brother. You are sinning against Christ, for whom your brother died. Matthew's Gospel, remember, Jesus says, as much as you do this to the least of my disciples, the least of my brothers, you do it to me. What we should be doing is building through love. So concerned for my brother and his conscience to build him up that I would not do anything to defile it, and therefore willing to restrain myself so that he will not be led astray. This massive concession in verse 13 where he says, if it causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again. For those of you who are vegetarians, that's a nothing. But for the rest of us, that is an enormous sacrifice to be paying. It's massive. To actually become a vegetarian rather than lead my brother astray is almost unthinkable. To rely on never enjoying the good things of food again, for that is how the Bible views meat and meat eating, the good things that are worth eating. To rely upon the good things that are worth eating and to say, I'm never going to have any of them again. I'll never enjoy another party, rather than leave my brother to fall astray. That's what he's saying. It's an extraordinary statement, verse 13. He says, but my brother's conscience is just too important for me to use my knowledge for my own self-satisfaction. For that kind of use of knowledge is puff-up knowledge. So you see, the passage then says very important things about our lives, important things about conscience, about gods, other gods, and about our knowledge. Our conscience needs to be informed and followed in this passage. Conscience needs to be informed. The weakness of the weak here is that their conscience is uninformed, is ill-informed. Conscience is I'm always terrified of this illustration because I don't understand it, but the conscience is like the program of the computer. You can plug in one program, and whatever program you plug in, it'll give out the answers. And if you don't like that program, you can take it out and you can put another program in, and it'll give out you completely different answers. Your conscience is like the program. It will give out whatever answers you have put in. That's exactly what it'll do. The conscience, the program God wants you to put in, is the Scriptures. If you put the Word of God in, you will get the Word of God's answers out on any and every situation of life you come to. But if you don't put the Word of God in, if you just put in what your mother and your grandmother said, or what your society says, or what you read in the newspapers, or heard on John Laws, if that's the program you put in, then they're the answers you're going to get out. And if your conscience is ill-informed, then the answers you get are going to be crazy. And the temptations you are under in terms of sin are going to be really weird. Because even good things that you could do, you'll be saying, they're bad things and I mustn't do them. And so you'll get yourself locked up in battles that you need never fight. Losing battles that you need never have entered into. And ignoring other battles that you should have been involved in. Conscience needs to be informed. Secondly, it's got to be followed. For whatever your conscience says to do, you should do. You must never go against your conscience. For to go against your conscience is to go against God. For you're saying, that is wrong, but I'm going to do it. That is to go against God. You must never go against your conscience. Once you put it that way, you see how important it is to have it properly informed in the first place, isn't it? Because if you're never to go against it, well, you've got to make sure it's right in the first place, haven't you? But do not go against your conscience. Second thing is about other gods. We need to acknowledge that they are there in the lives of people in our society. We need to acknowledge that there are powers at work that affect people, but we need to relegate them to where they are. They are not really rivals to God. There is only one God, and we must serve Him. We have been created by Him and for Him and through Him. Our whole lives are for Him. And although there may be powers and principalities in this world, they are under His control and power. And for Him and Him alone, we are to live. And thirdly, our knowledge is important, isn't it? But our knowledge must be governed by love. Otherwise, our knowledge is really arrogance. Our knowledge must be developed for the service of other people. For it is far, far more important to be known than to know. Far, far more important to be known by God than to know things about God. And who is it that is known by God? But those who love God. Well, we're going to have a time of prayer and we're going to have another song. But we'll have a couple of very quick questions. Three. Because I know it opens a whole can of worms, this passage, doesn't it? Three quick questions, three fast answers. One. Where does this leave us in terms of seeing someone, especially a new Christian, who you see doing something that is wrong? Where does this kind of passage leave you? How do you treat them, care for them, look after them, rebuke them, or whatever? First point is, you've got to check your own knowledge of the Word of God that it is wrong. See, I can see my brother doing something and say, oh, you shouldn't do that, but it may be that my conscience is weak. My conscience is ill-informed. So the first thing I need to do is to check that it is wrong. But when I see them doing that which is wrong, stealing computer programs or whatever it may be, you know, whatever form of theft that is going now, when I see them doing that which is wrong, what should I do? Well, Galatians 6 is the passage to turn to in that regard, because Galatians 6 verses 1 to 5 tells us how to look after the brother who has fallen into sin, to restore them with gentleness, looking to yourself, lest you too be tempted. Galatians 6, a lovely passage, first five verses. Second question. Third question. Oh, sorry, the second question's up there, Nick. How, How is the worship of the occult and astrology a form of idolatry? Idolatry is a big word. It means the worship of things that are not God, or the worship of God by things. So it covers a whole range of things. That is, the golden calf was an attempt to represent Yahweh, the God of Israel. They were worshipping the true God the wrong way. That's idolatry. The worship of the Baals was worshipping a God that didn't exist by statues. That also is idolatry. Worship means giving your life to, taking your lead from, obeying. So that materialism, covetousness, we're told in Colossians 3, I think it's verse 4, but it's Colossians 3, no, it must be after verse 4, about 7 or 8. Covetousness, materialism, is idolatry, because it is the worship of the physical world instead of the Creator who's given us all the physical world to enjoy. That is kind of non-religious idolatry, if you like. Astrology is classically idolatry because it's a belief that the planets and their particular arrangements and patterns control the way in which we live. And so people will identify themselves with a particular planetary system. And so I'm a Virgo, or I'm a Sagittarius, or I'm a Leo, and they'll wear little symbols around their necks, etc. I mean, they'll wear their Pisces symbol, their little fish around their neck, and get mistaken for Christians. Because they are saying, this is the thing that is the controlling influence upon my life and my character, my personality, and the kind of person that I'll marry happily and the kind of person I won't be able to marry happily. And they make their decisions on the basis of the arrangements of things, you see, of those constellations and stars. So that is idolatry. It's all part of the same broad bag of... Right? Now, astrologers tend not to offer sacrifices of meat to that. But it's still the same issue that Christians see. I know the stars are just markers put out there for us. The stars actually have no influence over me and my life at all. I know that. But I also know people who say to me, Philip, that's not true. Because I met this astrologer, just walked in, and he was able to tell me where I was born, he was able to tell me what my parents were, he was able to describe details about my life. You'd have to be in the know to know, and he just seemed to be able to tell me. And he had a knowledge that was beyond, and he predicted things about the future that just came true, and I think it was a load of rubbish. I just think it's just gobbledygook, it's stupid. But the person who's been involved in it says to me, no, it's not stupid. You don't understand, Philip. You've not been there. You've not been involved. Now, by my knowledge that there is no God, it's easy for me to say, blithering idiot, isn't he? You know, it really is silly. It's just a party game. It doesn't matter. But my knowledge is not building him up or helping him, is it? I've got to seek to build him up and to look after him and love him. And if his knowledge is lacking, then I must use my knowledge to try in love to speak the truth to him in order to inform him. But I mustn't do anything that would encourage him to engage himself in that which he feels the powers of the stars are involved in. Now that's a fairly easy one, but there are any numbers of them, aren't there? Alcohol's the same kind of deal, isn't it? See, the people who are fiercest against alcohol are the ex-alcoholics, because they have been under the power of it. They have felt the force that's involved. And they tend to want to say alcohol is evil. Well, the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible says God made alcohol for men to enjoy. Very, very different to what the Bible is saying. But for me to take a light and easy attitude towards alcohol in the company of an ex-alcoholic, as if you can ever be an ex-alcoholic, for me to take a light and easy attitude can be encouraging him to take a light and easy attitude towards something which he knows has a power over his life. I know it's not got a power. I know that God is the one who's created the good thing for people to enjoy. I can even know more about the physiology of why he has the addiction and a whole range of things like that, apart from... But my knowledge is not being helpful if I'm using it to give him spiritual problems. If I'm undermining his battle, my knowledge is really ungodly, isn't it? Because it is being used to destroy the brother for whom Christ died. Rather, I must be gladly drinking Coca-Cola rather than ever having alcohol, so as to not lead my brother astray, if that's where his problem is. Number three, here we go. I haven't heard you yet. Am I saying the demons and the evil spirits don't exist? No, no, I'm saying they do exist. But they are not God. Nor are they rivals to God. Nor are they alternatives to God. That is what they want to set themselves up as the alternative to God. But they are not God. And so that's why Paul is saying, yes, there are many gods and many lords. Many things that people give their lives to and come under the power of, but they're not God. There is only one God, ultimately. And so in the end, the devil is an agent of God. For God uses the devil to bring about his purposes. That gives us a problem, doesn't it? He is in opposition to God and he always opposes God. He is always fighting against God and always seeking to destroy God. But he is never a rival to God. Not really. Not effectively. And so the demons do exist. Yes. And they use false religion to give credence and power to that false religion, so as to deceive people into thinking that the false religion is actually true. The devil is the father of lies. Kubler-Ross, the classic illustration of it as far as I can see. For Kubler-Ross has taught us all to die in dignity and happiness. In fact, Kubler-Ross has made death popular. What she has taught us is that when you die, there is a warm, glowing light that attracts you on and makes you feel comfortable and reassured about what is going to happen in the future. She's done this from studies of people who have gone to a death experience and then recovered, you know, surgical situations, resuscitations of swimmers and so on. And she interviewed the people. What was it like when you died and came back to life? They said, oh, this lovely, warm, glowing light that just was so warm and attractive and led me on closer and closer and made me feel full of love and joy. And so by telling to people who are dying that that's what it's going to be like, she is able to help people die at peace and at ease and at comfort and remove anxiety and die with dignity. Now, of course, that is absolutely demonic. That is the devil himself. What message would the devil like people to hear more than any other than that after death there is no judgment? After death there is just love and warmth and acceptance. What message could make sure that no one would ever turn back in repentance to God and seek forgiveness than the message that death is full of a warm, glowing, loving experience? It is the exact message of the devil. She is working out of the demons. Very popular. And she's such a nice, winsome, loving soul, unlike me, crude, crass old Australian that I am, that people think it's an awful thing that I should say that she is actually doing the work of the devil. That she's somehow demonic or caught up in demonism. In fact, people want to say, look, Philip, even if she's wrong, you don't want to say it's demonic. You know, can't she just be wrong without it being kind of seen in those spiritual terms? Some years ago now, Time magazine wrote up Ms. Kubler-Ross and the fact that she was involved in a particular religion, that she wasn't just a secular psychiatrist, she was actually caught up in a religion. And her religion involved a guru who promised people sexual experiences with the supernatural. And she was living in the camp of the guru and paying enormous amounts of money to have these experiences of the other world, of spiritual forces and powers, and were caught up in. And the Time magazine exposed the fraudulent nature of this organisation and how I won't go into the details of it. The woman has been caught up in the religion of evil for a long, long time. And she has brought the message to the world that there is nothing to fear in death, we are all acceptable, which is the message of the devil. Oh, it's there, friends. And it comes to us in many, many guises. And those of us who have been touched by it before we've become Christian are very sensitive to it. And we need to get our consciences well trained in knowledge. Otherwise, in our weakness, we may be tempted to sin. And to those of us who have grown in knowledge or possibly never been affected by all this kind of thing, and find it really a bit weird that people could even think such thoughts, we need not only to have our consciences informed, but we need to use them in love, to be concerned for the building up of people and not for the destruction. Not for the arrogance of thinking ourselves better because we know something, but thankful to God that He knows us because we love Him. Remember the Ephesian church, the first of the seven churches that John writes to, Christ writes to in the book of the Revelation? The church that was full of knowledge was able to pick all the false apostles, but were going to be chopped off from their place because they had forgotten their first love. Beware of that danger, won't we?
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.